Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. It's Wednesday, April 14th, 2010. Today we're taking up confirmations. The first on our agenda is the appointments to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Citizens Board. Mr. Dan Foley and Ryan Benson. And why don't you both come up at the same time? That would be great. What I thought we could do is what we normally do is start with some introductory remarks, and you can give us some thoughts on the board you sit on, and talk about yourselves and your role, and perhaps even your vision for the organization. Mr. Foley, Dr. Foley?
Yeah, I'm Dan Foley, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself and forward to your remarks.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I've been a member of the Citizens Board for 26 years, and I guess this will be my last confirmation hearing because I'm not going to do this again. After 26, I have two more years to go in this particular term. I was originally appointed by Governor Perpich, and I've been privileged to serve the state under every governor subsequent to that. I'm an emergency physician and medical director of United Hospital here in St. Paul, and I'm a medical toxicologist. Over the 26 years, I guess there's different eras that I would put it in the beginning. I would call the biggest controversies were the garbage wars, building garbage incinerators, shipping garbage around the state, and how we manage solid waste. Then we went into an era of all of the expansion of hog farms and the issues related to hog manure and I would say the problems because of the potential smell and how you deal with all of that. And now we're in an era of more expansion of dairies and very large agribusiness. The issues before the Pollution Control Board, which in the beginning was actually the Citizens Board, actually the chair was a member of the Citizens Board. Now the chair is the commissioner appointed by the governor. I served in that role for 8 years, and I really do appreciate the complexity of people and the juxtaposition of agriculture and the expansion of business in this state. That really is a very difficult thing when you approach it from the standpoint of the environment. How do we as people control our environment such that we are not the causes of our own demise? I think this state has taken a hard look at being able to do that. We have a current question in front of the state, the potential expansion of incineration of hazardous substances at the 3M Cottage Grove plant that are not generated by 3M, but clearly are hazardous substances that have to be dealt with in some fashion here in the state. So we do have the technical capacity at the agency to really understand these, and working closely with the legislature, the ability to work with citizens as an open board. We are a forum for people to discuss directly with the board issues that are important in their life related to the environment, whether it's air quality, hazardous substance, or water quality. And that's a privilege that for the last 26 years I've really appreciated, the ability to have direct dialogue with citizens and to work to try to resolve the problems that this state faces. And I've also had the privilege to serve with many, many people who come from all walks of life who take that board and that agency very seriously. And I would stand for any questions.
Dr. Foley, as a doctor, what observations and opinions can you offer us on the future of public health in Minnesota as it relates to what the PCA is involved in.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senators, well, as a physician and toxicologist who's observed this and been involved with it, I think the agency has worked well for the people of Minnesota in being able to understand and measure the potential impacts of human activity, and really serving as a major forum for, as I spoke before, issues related to agribusiness, which really have a potential of affecting our water sources, which are so very important. Recently, we've been dealing with the expansions of ethanol plants and how corn as a food source and now as an energy source are used, and the appropriation of that precious water. I think from our standpoint at the board, we have to follow state law to try to understand how do we balance the energy needs and now the water appropriation needs in order to produce ethanol as a fuel source. I think that's something that you have taken up a number of times and something I think all of us to pay attention to. I'm hoping as a physician and an advocate for public health that we will be able to interrupt the use of foodstuffs as a source of energy, except for the fact of what we might use it for in order to eat and sustain people. So trying to figure out alternatives that we can produce that also serve agricultural interests of the state, but maybe using other types of fuel sources, I think would be very important. Our air quality, I think, is as good as it's ever been. We do have, from time to time, air inversions that do affect the air quality. Our understanding of the physical effects of particulate matter, both PM10, 10 micron level, and PM2.5, which are even the smaller, more penetrating particles, are very important. Just within the last 10 days, in most of our emergency rooms, we saw a big increase in asthma patients, and that's really a function of some of those small penetrating particles, all the activity that's going on with our cars and dust particles that we really have to pay attention to.
In terms of public health, how would you rank air, water, and land in terms of the biggest need to address by the state of Minnesota in terms of public health?
Water, I would put number one. Then I follow it. The land use issues I don't get into, so but the followed by air, how we regulate point sources, particularly point sources that produce a fair amount of particulate matter and potentially hazardous matter, is also very important. Now, we have interestingly, the Allen S. King plant, which is one of the, that and Black Dog plant are the two plants that burn coal that serve to produce electricity for the Twin Cities. Allen S. King is strategically positioned, of course, to affect Wisconsin in a greater way than it is Minnesota, because it's in Bayport and the prevailing winds take what we do and what we use it for into Wisconsin. So we have to pay very close attention to how we regulate those kinds of point sources because of how massive they are. And I think over the last few years, the way that Xcel has run those stacked precipitators has really been pretty good. We're able to measure very well that type of activity, but be cognizant that we're really affecting our Wisconsin neighbors as opposed to ourselves.
And within the water category that mm-hmm. you ranked highest, where should we be looking at?
The thing that concerns me the most is water appropriation. the particularly in southwestern Minnesota, the more water we're taking out of the ground for general agricultural purposes, we have a hierarchy of use, human water consumption, and then followed by agricultural use and other uses. When we take 5 gallons of water out for pretty much every gallon of ethanol that we're producing, some of these plants are taking a very large amount of water out of areas that is a very scarce resource. It's not the same that we've seen with the studies we've done in the southeastern part of the state, where there is a massive amount of water in the Jordan Prairie du Chien aquifer. But you can imagine Rochester itself appropriates over 1 billion gallons of water a year for human consumption. And you add all of the agricultural uses and industrial uses, we are taking a lot of precious water out of the ground. We have a much better understanding from the U.S. Geological Survey, the Minnesota Geological Survey, University of Minnesota, that looks at this issue in detail about where in the state we have adequate resources and where we don't. So I think in the last 10 years we have a lot more knowledge about what water resources we have that we can actually use. And I think that's an area that the legislature should pay attention to.
Mr. Steben, did you have your hand up?
I do have some questions. Doctor, thank you for being here today. I was interested to hear your comments about the 3M incinerator, mm-hmm. and would like you to expand on that more if you would. As the representative of that area,
sure.
You're really aware that the community is firmly opposed to the expansion of the incinerator, and you seem to imply that there is waste coming, there would be hazardous waste coming just from within Minnesota. But obviously the permit would allow hazardous waste from other states to ship their hazardous waste material here to Minnesota to be processed. And I think that the broader implication is one that the MPCA has reiterated at some community meetings, is that there's no differentiation in Minnesota statute right now between commercial hazardous waste incinerators and non-commercial hazardous waste incinerators. And so the MPCA has said, well, since there's no differentiation, we're just going to permit them and allow the company to bring in waste from non-3M sources from places outside of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, and I'm sure you're aware, that the mayor, the city council, they're going to come to the citizens board to ask you as a representative on that board to try to stop the permit.
Right.
I tried to offer an amendment in the finance committee and was unsuccessful a couple weeks back. But so now the citizens really see their only, or not even the citizens, but also the local units of government only see their recourse to try to stop the long-standing agreement, which was between the city of Cottage Grove and the 3M Corporation, that only 3M waste would be incinerated there. It didn't matter if it was from any 3M facility in North America.
Right.
So this is not a NIMBY, not in my backyard type of issue. This is the people of my district saying, we don't want to become a hazardous waste incinerator for the rest of the country. And what implications does that have for our community in the Southeast Metro to allow this to move forward?
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Foley,
Senator Steben, we've dealt with the 3M Cottage Grove plant and that incinerator for many years. I've actually personally been down there a number of times to look at its operation and look at its output. I guess from the PCA standpoint, at least as a board member, our charge is can they operate that incinerator to do the job of destroying completely hazardous substances that meet both federal and state law? Can we make it safe? Can I look those people in the eye and say, can we, based upon a reasonable degree of measurement and certainty, be able to say that the operations of that plant causes chemical destruction of hazardous substances that would be brought to it? Now, the sources of it is not under my purview. The Commerce Clause of the Constitution creates a free movement of substances. We faced this a number of years ago when we were trying to permit a number of garbage burning plants and actually say that we only wanted them to accept waste that were generated within the state of Minnesota. As reasonable as that sounds, it violates the law. And so, therefore, you're absolutely correct. I don't think that this state, because hazardous waste is actually a commodity, because somebody can actually benefit from its destruction, probably can be shipped to this plant from all over the country. And so our job would be to say to you and to the citizens of Cottage Grove and its environs, can we take a very hard look at the operations of that plant and the types of waste that would be destroyed there and assure to the people that that operation will actually destroy it in a way that would meet all of the rules and requirements of the state of Minnesota. I think that's our charge.
Mr. Chair, and just to follow up with that, Dr. Foley, there will be approximately 60 million more pounds of hazardous waste being incinerated there. And right now, I think that that's one of the, as we've learned more about this proposal, that's one of the problems is that particulate matter, VOCs, they're all way below, they're burning right now what they're permitted, they're actually processing, their output is much lower than what they're permitted. Right. So 3M is correct to say they'll still be with under their permitted levels, but that's of no real it doesn't bring great comfort to the community because they're already so below their levels that they're not going to go up substantially more, but they're still processing 60 million more pounds of hazardous waste, and there will be more output. And I think that one thing that often happens with state agencies, too, and I know that this, you know, I get pretty frustrated when we talk about the environmental pollution of my district from the 3M Corporation, not just for this incinerator now, but also from the PFCs, is what's the real benefit to the community to increase that level, to allow 60 million more pounds? There's no added benefit in terms of property value. In fact, the mayor and others have said they're concerned that it will decrease the property value in the area. There's no, you know, additional revenue that comes in by generating this new waste. And this probably isn't fair to direct completely at you, but I do it as a way to help educate other legislators, too, is that there are decisions that the state could make regarding whether the facility is a commercial hazardous waste facility or not. And if we make different decisions, that could impact. There could be a benefit either to the state of Minnesota or to my local community for the additional processing of these wastes. But right now, under the current proposal, the city, the residents are saying they don't want it, and there's no benefit for them to take it. So I just urge you to I appreciate that you've toured the plant, and you know I'd encourage you to meet with the mayor and other members who are actively opposed to this in the community, as we try to figure out. You know, because we're not saying we want to shut the incinerator down. We're just saying we don't want this additional waste. There's a long-standing agreement between the city and the corporation that they'd only process 3M waste, and now they're violating that agreement, and there's no recourse. There's nothing that the city can do, and it's.
Mr.
Really
Chairman, Senator Sieben, what I can assure you is that as an individual member of the agency, I will take as hard a scientific look at whatever the proposal is, understand all the technical ramifications, and it isn't, as you well know, it isn't just that plant, but you have Ashland Oil just down the street, and you have Flint Hills or Coke Refinery just across the river. So the air impacted in your district, we do understand that, and we would take that mass balance effect into account as we deliberate should you be expanding it. Their current destructive capability for that particular hazardous substance that they use is way under what we permitted them, And that's, your point is very well made. But all I can assure to you is that I will use our best judgment to look at how do all these other factors affect your area and whether they then meet the test to be able to get a permit based upon applicable state laws and rules.
Let's hear from Mr. Benson, and then I think some of our questions may apply to both candidates. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Brian Benson. I'm the county administrator from Sherburne County and live in on a farm outside of St. Cloud. I was first appointed by Governor Ventura and then the last two terms by Governor Pawlenty. And so I've served 10 years on the board. I've been the administrator in Sherburne County for 11 or 12 and in county government for about 32 years. Before being an administrator, I ran the environmental department in our county, started early on with PCA and the University of Minnesota Extension to get classes going for septic installers, for inspectors, for landfill inspectors and operators. And, in fact, was licensed myself in all those areas over the course of the year. So I have a lot of solid waste experience, a lot of septic and wastewater treatment experience that I bring to the board. One thing I really appreciate in serving on the board with Dr. Foley and the other members is the diversity of experience and expertise that we do have. We have agricultural operators. We have folks from labor and industry. We have Dr. Foley as a medical expert, and it brings a very good, very well-rounded discussions at our board. I think I was thinking, driving down today, with the things that will stick in my mind from being on the board, and I think a couple of them are worth noting. The first is probably the MERP project to reduce mercury from the metropolitan plants. One plant was shut down, others, significant investment in technology by Xcel and the state legislature contributed to that, and the work on the technical level that the PCA staff did. I think that's a long-term huge improvement in air quality and water quality in Minnesota. The other is what's called a phosphorus rule, and that's a limitation on the amount of phosphorus that can be discharged in wastewater treatment plants. It's required on upgrading of permits and new permits for new facilities, and it's spurred technology changes and operational changes that have really reduced the nutrients going into our surface waters. So I think those are two very important things that happened during my tenure on the board. I'd be happy to answer questions, Senator.
Could the both of you perhaps comment on any observations you've had regarding the emergence of non-ferrous mining in Minnesota? And although up until now the PCA has not been largely involved, it has had some involvement and will be doing some permitting regarding those projects. So, have you followed the issue, and whether you have or not, what are your observations regarding non-ferrous mining? Dr. Pollins?
Mr. Chairman, I have followed the issue. I mean, mining is an important part of northeastern Minnesota. And in my time there, we've dealt with a lot of issues related to the permitting of ferrous mining facilities and tailings and leachate, and et cetera. It, non-ferrous brings a new dimension to a similar industry. And the question is going to be what types of chemical extraction that might be utilized in order to get other elements out. I know that there are precious metals in northeast Minnesota that people are going to want to extract. In some parts of the world, a large amount of mercury is utilized to help get gold and other types of precious metals out. That's a big issue. That's not something that I think myself or my colleagues or the agency that we represent is interested in trading one chemical problem for another. So we have to take a hard look at it. Then how you deal with the tailings and the reclamation, the water issues that follow. You may remember a number of years ago in an old mine pit we had some fish farms for salmon. We had water issues. Anytime you excavate that ground up there, there's a water recharge that comes out. You get a new lake. So the water issues there related to chemical use and how they actually extract the precious metals from the base ore is going to be very, very important and one that we will pay particular attention to.
Mr. Benson?
We have, in the last couple of years, looked at the area quite a bit as some of the ferrous mining companies have upgraded and tried to make value-added products, I guess is the correct way of saying it, to further refine and create new processes to be shipping a more high-quality product. And so some of these past mothball plants have started up again and started up with new environmental or updated environmental regulations. And so the PCA board has looked at the area, and we've not yet had a permit for the non-ferrous projects, but we have a number of us have toured the area and looked at some of the areas where they're anticipating mining the non-ferrous copper nickel, and gone through with their geologists to look at the kind of things available and the kind of geological structures they're coming out of. It's a very complex problem, and it's going to be one that's going to take serious consideration from our board.
A couple of years ago, it was fairly recent, there was an accidental discharge at the Monticello nuclear plant into the Mississippi River. Thousands of fish, particularly game fish, were found dead. I'm not sure if the human health impacts were ever studied, but I know when you see thousands of dead fish, there was something happened. Now, I think the DNR indicated that was mostly because of the sudden change in temperature. But could you both of you describe your roles as citizen board members, what things you did when that happened?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I could, because I've maybe been involved a little bit longer. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency only has a NPDES permit for nuke plants. They're under the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as long as they keep whatever they're doing inside their containment vessel. My understanding of that particular event was a temperature water shock that substantially changed the temperature of the water that affected those fish. Also, any discharge that comes out of those plants, be it Prairie Island or Monticello, has tritium, which is a radioactive hydrogen particle. And we're able to measure that. That's what the NPDES permit that the PCA, representing the EPA, actually regulates. And so we do get quarterly reports from Xcel on the operations of those plants with regard to tritium discharge, water temperatures, et cetera. And I think you accurately reflect what the DNR thought and what our water experts thought was the origin of that fish kill. because we're able to measure tritium quite precisely, it really did not appear to be a radioactive event. It appeared to be a very hot water discharge event.
It was accidental nonetheless.
My understanding.
Did the PCA alter its permit in any way to prevent future accidents?
I don't think we altered the NPDES permit, but I think there were consequences for the accident and consequences for whatever was the cause of valve failure or whatever. They have to also, they're under the jurisdiction, as I said, of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They were subject to also their review. And I think there were state consequences as well as EPA consequences, along with the Nuclear Regulatory for that particular event. Overall, I might say, Mr. Chairman, what we know of that particular plant and Prairie Island, they're some of the best-run nuclear plants in this nation. And just recently, Prairie Island was reclassified, which was one of the first in the nation to get a reclassification operating license. That was due to be shut down in 2014.
Chairman?
Mr. Benson, you want to comment on
only that
Monticello discharge?
Certainly, Senator. I had more involvement from my day job, as we have the other shore of the Mississippi River across from Monticello. And most of the emergency management and emergency controls are located at our county government center. So most of that information and the immediate reaction and the first reaction to that kind of a spill comes through my county. So I was aware of it there. Dr. Foley's correct in his assessment that it seemed to be mostly a temperature issue. It was an accident, and they were dealt with in their permit by the feds regulating.
In what way?
They had to rewrite their operational procedures. There was a mechanical failure, if I recall, on one of the valve pieces, and so the design and installation of that was reviewed and changed.
Fredrickson, did you have your hand up?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I did. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Foley, in your answer, you talked about a reclassification of the Prairie Island license. What was the nature of that reclassification? What's the significance?
They would give them. They're considering giving them an additional 20 years to operate that plant. Yeah. Instead of, if they don't, they're going to have to shut it down. And generally, they move the contaminated reactor to Richland, Washington, like they did with Elk River a number of years ago, the Elk River containment vessel.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Foley, I just did not hear it as a reclassification. It's just a relicensing for its extended operation for another 20 years.
Yeah, I think the technical deal is called a reclassification, but in sum and substance, Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, it's a extension of their operating license.
I'll hold on my question, Senator Kielash. Go ahead.
This is to both of you. The role of the Citizens Board is to oversee set direction for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the commissioner is responsible for carrying out the wishes of the board. I'm just curious as to how well you think the commissioner is doing his job as far as taking directions from the board and pursuing the direction that you've set for them.
Dr. Foley or Mr. Bennett?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, just historically, when the PCA started, the commissioner or executive director wasn't a member of the board. The legislature and the governor actually made the commissioner the chairman of the board a number of years ago. So the chairman, the commissioner as chair, works with the board quite directly. the current commissioner is very informative, is very open to discussion of issues or any issue that any individual or collective members may have. I think bringing the commissioner onto the board was a unified operations financial responsibility along with policy direction that the board had. So I think things have operated quite well since that time. That happened under Commissioner Williams. You may remember that a number of years ago. I and the last few commissioners, I believe that the board as a whole has had a very good, frank dialogue about the issues and the ability to get appropriate information that individual members need to make individual judgments. We sit as individuals, and I've been very pleased. My remarks might say that at times there have been other commissioners who we felt weren't as open, but that's not the case today.
Could I follow up? Mr. Chair, I think one of my questions, it's like you identified water as being a big issue for the state of Minnesota, and the southwestern Minnesota's aquifers may, because of the amount of water being taken out for corn production. Is that something that, as the board, you're suggesting that they more aggressively go after that or not go after? Part of it is that it's one thing to make it say we would like to see this happen to the commissioner, and another thing for him to pursue it as aggressively as you would like, or his your priorities are the same as his. That I see where you can, you know, where the commissioner being on the board helps with the communications and all that, but are they really doing the work that the board, Citizens Board, has set out for them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in my opinion, well, the DNR is actually in charge of appropriation. Mm-hmm. So we look at the whole water source, and then what does an individual appropriation, how does it affect the drawdown of other users with the state-mandated hierarchy of water use, and would it affect that aquifer in any negative and or positive way? And so from the current commissioner and the kind of the water cabinet of the state, I believe that an appropriate attention to that detail is being paid, and any time I, or in seeing, and my colleague can speak for himself, or my colleagues have asked for specific information, be that either from PCA staff, from federal sources, and or then we do bring in the DNR from time to time, because as sister agencies in this water relationship, they have knowledge related to those appropriations and their rules that we need to understand. And I think we have a frank dialogue about it. I haven't always liked individual appropriators' drawdowns, et cetera, but we question them pretty hard, and we've had a number of plants that have had to cut their water appropriation in half, and that means their ethanol production, because of a better understanding of local micro effects that that plant might have on other higher hierarchical users of that water.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Senator
Ingebrigtsen.
Are you done?
Are we just going to let him respond?
Oh, Mr. Benson, did you want to comment?
Just responding to the senator. Real briefly, at a little different level, I think the coordination between the health department, the DNR, and the PCA, I think under our more recent commissioners, has really improved. We do get good information from our colleagues at the health department and the DNR, and I think rather than being isolated silos, it's flowing much more freely, and we certainly benefit from that at the Citizens Board.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just real quickly, getting back to what this kind of addresses, not addresses, but I'm inquiring about Senator Sieben's question with regards to the burning of waste. There's some value, offset energy values to the waste-to energy facilities that we have in Minnesota. I'd just like to hear your comments about that, and I guess I don't know whether that one has any. There is none in that one. Okay, so I know we have at least two of them in my district, waste burners to energy. What does the group feel about those, or are they?
Dr. Foley?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think at one time we had 17 operating garbage burners in the state of Minnesota. I don't know exactly today how many we have. I think a few of them have cut down their operation because, as I said when Senator Sieben asked me, we initially, the agency felt a number of years ago that we should be only burning garbage that's produced in the state of Minnesota. And we were quickly told by the courts that that's not possible and that garbage is a commodity and it goes to not only waste to energy. I call them garbage burners just because I want everybody to understand what we're doing there. But the waste to energy facilities and industry is competing with landfills and recycling and organic recycling and all the other potential users of what we throw away. And so Red Wing has two waste energy garbage burners that we review all of their outputs, mainly the inputs are decided by local use permits and what the counties want to do with their garbage. And then we as the PCA have to determine whether they can operate the burner, be that a refuse-derived fuel where they do fuel separation before it goes into a burner, or in the case of the Minneapolis plant, which is a mass burn facility, where everything goes in there and then you take the ferrous metals and other metals out of there in order to continue operation, that what comes out those stacks is what we have to measure to assure to the people who may be potentially impacted that they can operate it safely within federal, state, and local law, and understanding the potential toxicity, issues of dioxin and all these operational characteristics that are required in order to run an incinerator to assure destruction of potential toxic substances that could affect people. And that's what we look at. And on a quarterly basis, we're getting information to the agency, and we at the board are looking at the operational characteristics, getting reports about those particular facilities as they operate on their five-year permit cycles.
Just to follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair, so in your evaluation, are you considering the energy that is being generated? Now, that's being sold or utilized by other entities, whether they be public or private, and, of course, then them not having to purchase natural gas, fuel oil, quite frankly, electricity, whatever else they use for energy. So is that considered in pretty heavy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I personally consider that. But, the farther these plants are away from true end users of that transmitted electricity, the larger amount of the energy is lost in impedance to transfer. So that's an issue. I felt that when you were looking at the issue of the Big Stone plant in South Dakota, that we knew that about a fourth of the energy produced gets lost in impedance in the line. So there's a big loss. Closer you are to where the end user quickly can utilize it and the least amount that you have to transfer it. And then it's the offset that I think you're getting at, so that if we're producing some energy from our garbage and we're able to expand our industry that runs on electricity, I don't see anybody, Senator, really wanting to turn the lights down or off. I never see that. And so it all of that is very relevant. This state has actually had fairly cheap energy for a long, long time. When we were charging 6.7 cents per kilowatt hour, San Francisco was paying 27 cents. And I felt that the two things that Minnesota had that was very, very important for our kind of economic life here and the interaction economically was we had pretty cheap energy because we have a multiplicity of sources, whether it's nuclear, coal, or garbage. And we have both water quality and water quantity. And though all those things are necessary for the type of life that we have today, and I think we continue to actually have a fairly cheap energy in the state of Minnesota when we compare it to around the country. And I think it has to do with that mix that we have.
Thank you.
Darren Dibble.
Thanks. I know we've got a lot of folks in front of us. If we could just have a quick discussion. I think we're kind of running through a variety of issues here. In front of the PC, I want to just bring up the subject of invasive species and biological hazards to our surface waters in particular. I know that there's a certain aspect of this that the DNR has responsibility for, but I think there's also some thought that, especially when it comes to viral hemorrhagic septicemia, that the PCA has a role to play there. And I know that we've got some rules and we've got some federal activity and the like. I just wonder if you could share your thoughts for a few minutes on PCA's role in protecting our waters from these sorts of things, the VHS in particular, but some of these invasives that we're struggling with, most of which much of which is being introduced through the Great Lakes, of course, in the shipping industry.
We've had in the last year an agreement on regulation of ship ballast water and Lake Superior and coming into the Minnesota ports. I think the Great Lakes Compact has come together on those regulations. I'm not sure if they've adopted them formally, but the majority of that is for controlling bringing species in from either other Great Lakes or more likely from ocean-going vessels. That's a major first step. It's something Minnesota took the lead in, and I think it's very timely. I don't know how we deal with the carp, but we haven't seen them at our doors yet. I hope we don't. The medical issues I'll leave to the medical expert.
Well, VHS is an invasive microorganism that affects our fish, and our surface waters, and the real threat to our sport fishing industry and our commercial fishing industry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, your point's very well made. Over my term, we've had a lot of issues, particularly with the St. Louis River, Duluth Harbor, reclamation of the old Arrowhead Refinery. And it brings up all of the kind of issues that require multi-agency jurisdiction, be they with Canada and or with the feds. So in the last 10 years, we've dealt with a lot of things related to Duluth and Lake Superior that involve looking at that and the discharge of ballast water, et cetera. Minnesota, through the MPCA, recently passed some rules that are the most stringent there in the Great Lakes Basin related to ballast water discharge. I mean, wasn't appreciated as much by the shipping industry, but I think Minnesota was rightly concerned about that and the introduction of be they viral and or other type of organisms that are not native to the Great Lakes is a big issue and affects or potentially affects an important fishery that we have to preserve at all costs. So taking hard issues and requiring multi-states and Canada with the United States
you know that the International Joint Commission on the Great Lakes, both Canada and the United States, has the major jurisdiction, but the Corps of Engineers has been actively involved. And our hard look at the Duluth Harbor and all of the issues related to that gave us an opportunity at the PCA board to really look at all of the regulation and regulatory complexity related to that Great Lake, and I think you have a much better appreciation for that. And the commissioner, current commissioner, and others are very concerned and want Minnesota to continue to take a lead in that regulation. And I, from a policy standpoint, I applaud that as a member of the board. It's a very, very important water source. Second largest freshwater accumulation in the world, behind Lake Baikal.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon, and then I think we should probably start moving to some of the other affirmations.
Thank you. Senator Chaudhry, I have just a few questions. One is that I do, I would be interested in both of your speaking to what often is discussed about the permitting process being lengthy, overburdensome, too many layers, too many departments involved, to the point that it doesn't really create achievement of the goals, but really creates a problem in being able to have industrial growth in the state that we, in fact, do want to have happen here. I would be interested in your response to that, and then I have some another follow-up question.
Mr. Benson?
One of my interests when I came on the board, Senator, was that permitting time. I heard as much from municipalities as I did from private industries, and many of the wastewater treatment plants that cities were operating were beyond their permit time and sometimes years beyond their permit time. Over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, the two or three commissioners serving at that time have improved that dramatically. They've worked on internal processes that had more rigid expectations of how long it should take to do something, how long it should take to turn it around. And so in that kind of facilities, permitting has improved dramatically. Case by case, like a large mining proposal, it's more difficult to streamline because each piece of information is unique. And there's often the desire that if we're going to err, we're going to err on the side of caution with the environment. And so it's hard. It's harder to balance that, although it's always a consideration of the board and I think our commissioner now to make sure that we're not unduly holding up something that it's a legitimate issue before it gets held up.
Thank you. And, of course, you can't move the mine, so they aren't going to go someplace else if that's where true. The resource is. The it just sort of follows up on that because I heard – Dr. Foley, you talking about ethanol in a way that concerned me because I think that you were describing a water utilization level that is not current from the practices that I am familiar with coming from a part of the state that does have a strong interest in ethanol. And also that there is a byproduct from corn that is a protein that's used for feed and does feed the public. So I was concerned at what you were saying and concerned whether or not the information is old at PCA. Is it influencing and creating problems for ethanol plants to expand and to meet what we've established as a goal for ethanol as a part of the overall solution to becoming energy independent. So I'm just very interested. Is there something that can assure me that that ethanol is getting understood properly based on current information, including all of their water conservation plans and activities that they've engaged in, the reutilization of water, so that they aren't running up against an attitude in the permitting process.
Dr. Foley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for that question. You know, in the beginning, I think just about every one of the ethanol-producing plants appropriated about 5 gallons per gallon of ethanol produced. As they saw in the permitting process, as they saw the hard look that we were taking, as well as DNR, on the appropriation of that amount of water per production of a gallon of ethanol, you began to see the industry change rather dramatically to decrease their appropriation as well as their discharge of water. So the beginning plants discharged a fair amount of water, and which had to be treated and at a cost, et cetera, and then the concerns that we had as to what the receiving waters, how they would be affected. So you are absolutely correct. In the last few years, I think the last two that I saw that we went through the permitting process, one, they had eliminated their discharge of water, and two, they had decreased their appropriation substantially. But the others that were originally permitted continue to appropriate a fair amount of water. One plant that was in the southwestern part of the state actually was going to be a 75-million-gallon ethanol-producing plant, appropriating 5 gallons per gallon of ethanol produced. And when we took a very, very hard look and, in fact, required all kinds of different drawdown tests to look at that affected aquifer, that plant came back and cut their permitted production down to 55 million gallons. And also decreased by changing their method, the amount of water that they were actually going to appropriate per gallon produced. So these are hard looks that we take. I think you indicate that there have been major changes in the industry, and that's correct. The wet cake that is left over is used as an animal feed and eventually is also consumed by us in the meat production. It's an industry that's under change. I think we'll find that we probably won't be using corn in the future for that, though, because there are cheaper grasses and chemicals that will be produced, furans or others, that actually have more energy per molecule that will give us more energy in our ever-increasing use of energy. So the University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin are looking at these things greatly. If I could, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would like to just respond to the previous question that you had. Are there things in the environmental review that are difficult? You don't see many environmental impact statements unless it's really mandatory. We've had a few in the last couple of years that we have required after reviewing environmental assessment worksheets. When I first started doing this, a worksheet was just that. It was about 4 pages, and they answered questions, and you looked at it, and it sounded reasonable. Now the environmental assessment worksheets are basically disguised environmental impact statements. They're 2 to 3 feet thick. They've had consultants. They're very complex documents, but don't meet all of the parameters of an environmental impact statement, meaning there's not the alternative analyses, economic impacts, some of the other things that required that the legislature and the governor in legislation require an environmental impact statement to have. I participated for a year and a half a number of years ago under the Environmental Quality Board, along with industry members and environmental group participation in looking at the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, and could we somehow create an intermediate document? So, the difficulty with an environmental impact statement, Senators, is it can't be done in under a year by all of the public notice requirements, et cetera. So as soon as an EIS is either required or stipulated by us or a regulatory body, you're not going to see that thing for in under a year. And the cost of that is substantial. Then you have the immediate purpose of the environmental assessment worksheet, which is no longer what it was a number of years ago when we started with this agency. So we were trying to look at, is there some sort of an intermediate document that could be put into statute that could have some parameters there that would better define what we're kind of seeing today, EAWs disguised as EISs that are very expensive. And after about a year of discussion, I would say both sides, industry and the environmental groups, neither wanted you to open up the Environmental Policy Act for fear that on one side it would be watered down and on the other it would get more complex. I, as a citizen, would say to you, I'd like to see that intermediate document. It would be good for industry. It would be good, I think, for the regulators so you have something that isn't so expensive and so time-consuming that it either scares industry to not come here people do fight to try to just delay things so that these things will go away. That is true. And there are good projects that I think have left this state because they knew they were headed for an EIS and it would be too expensive. I don't have an answer for you, but that's the dilemma.
Well, I think this committee would welcome your suggestions on that. I, for one, would be happy to work with you on developing a proposal for that type of thing. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the committee recommend the Senate confirm the appointment of Dr. Daniel Foley, Brian Benson to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Citizen Board.
Further discussion? Any other questions? I'll save my question. As long as we were talking about permitting, I was interested in your views on enforcement within the PCA, but perhaps we can leave that to a more informal discussion at another time. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you,
Thank
gentlemen.
You. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Berner.
Yeah, you served with him.
This is the first time that we have this is the second time, only the second time we have considered confirmations for the citizen members of the former LCMR. I remember that we confirmed Mr. Berner a couple of years ago, and so now we're back again. Mr. Berner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Alfred Berner, and I come from the Mankato area of Minnesota, where my wife and I own a small farm. It's not much of an operational farm anymore because of my background in wildlife. And so my interest on the LCMR, because of all the projects over the years, has been particularly oriented towards land use and its impacts on wildlife. But in the time that I've spent on the committee, 3 years, I've really learned a lot. Just shows that no matter how old you get, you can learn something. And from all the members of the committee, it's been a very interesting and worthwhile and rewarding experience. Thank you.
What would you like to do on the LCCMR from here on in?
Well, of course, one change has been made, was going from an annual appropriation to a biannual appropriation again, which we've gone back to the original LCCMR. So that, in a sense, gives us an opportunity to, at one time, allocate more money to the people looking to meet our needs as far as we put out in our RFPs. I think I would still prefer to emphasize the impacts of land use. And, of course, you know, we talk about water being very important, and it is, but the thing is that how water is affected is how we use the land. And so much of our focus on water always seems to begin at the edge of the water instead of looking up into the uplands of the water on where it's occurring, whether it's coming through a pipe, across the land, or through the air. In fact, I don't think a lot of people realize a lot of erosion that in the past, not as much now, but in the past that got into waters is actually airborne. Wind erosion, I believe Minnesota was like second or third in the nation between Texas and North Dakota. We were fighting it out for years, particularly out of the Red River Valley. Now that we have better conservation tillage methods, we've reduced that greatly. But people would look at it and say, oh, yeah, it's a problem. But a lot of that ended up in our lakes and our streams, and we didn't look at it as an on-point source pollution. So I guess our emphasis would be mainly the two things is continue to look at our land use, try to preserve the best areas we can because you only can keep them once. Once they're gone, we're finding out you can't recreate a prairie, for instance. And the other thing is to gather information that we need to make better decisions in the future.
Questions for Mr. Berner? Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question. I've known Mr. Berner for many, many years, going back to when he worked for the Department of Natural Resources and was at the Medelia Station. So I think Mr. Berner is well known to many of us in this committee. I'm wondering when you'd like to have a motion. Some of us in this committee have worked with him for many years. And
as soon as we're done with any questions. I guess, Mr. Berner, with the discussions of LCCMR appropriations being so topical in the legislature and some of the issues surrounding them, what are your opinions on some of the legislative discussions that have gone on? Whether it be changing, as far as changing the LCCMR's appropriations, some of the reasons why that are given. What are your feelings on the matter?
Well, I certainly understand the political dilemma that many of our legislators, or all of our legislators are facing right now with our budget constraints and so on. But I think we have to look back at why the Environmental Trust Fund came about and also why we have the legacy funding, is that people of Minnesota are very concerned about our environment, and they were trying to put in place a process that would be able to ride the waves of the political waves of trying to manipulate these monies. And as far as what the discussion has been, as the major thing is, should we be acquiring more land? I understand some of the concerns they have as far as what they call tails. I understand this, but the big problem is that sometimes there are opportunities to acquire lands that will have great value in the future, that if you don't do it now, you're going to lose it. And we've seen all too often the losses. For instance, because there was no foresight, we only have, 0.1% of our prairies left. And in the agricultural part, our wetlands are less than 10% of what was originally there. With better vision, perhaps we could have, we know we could save them all, but at least we'd have a viable unit of habitats in that part of the state. So I think from the standpoint that, I guess from a member of this board of 17 people, 10 legislatures, 5 citizen members, go through a grueling and very interesting procedure, and I know that you folks go through a grueling procedure too, but we are specifically focusing on these particular projects and have screened them, and I think we do have a fairly good balance. I find that no one likes to be second-guessed, I guess. And unless, I think that, for instance, the acquisition portion, there were members that would have liked half of the budget to go to acquisition. As you see, it was maybe about 1/5. went to acquisition, which shows the balance on our committee. So I personally would strongly suggest that we maintain the package as is and not mess around with it. If there's some other direction that the legislature wants us to take, perhaps they should communicate that with us in a much broader sense and give us some ideas on how we might address those concerns in the future.
And that's not to mention that there was an amendment, at least in the Senate, to reduce much of the research as well.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Berner, I'm impressed with your list of publications. You've been busy, and it looks like you've got a lot of good articles there and research papers that you've put out. I was interested in your comments about land use. Could you comment on how you feel about urban sprawl and local planning and zoning and maybe statewide actions or influence that the state could do to improve planning and zoning at the local level to try to do a better job of controlling urban sprawl?
Mm-hmm. Well, out in our neck of the woods, thank you, Senator. In our neck of the woods, the county has taken some efforts to, control urban sprawl in a helter-skelter type of fashion, and through the 40 acres and also hooking up to municipal sewer where possible. And I think one of the things we need to do is consolidate this development. And if we consolidate our development as much as possible, I think we will find we will get other benefits from the standpoint of particularly, say, in the metro area, all of a sudden mass transit will look much more favorable to the people in those areas. Whereas right now, with a broad urban sprawl and sprawling out and in small communities, the only thing we have available is to use the auto and means more roads. If we look at the European model, the cities were consolidated, and therefore you have a focused area, a loci, where mass transit makes sense to go from one place to another by high-speed trains and so on. And I'm hoping they continue along those lines of, say, looking at particularly our municipal wastes and using that as a leverage, and then our transportation as the other leverage to start to consolidate and focus our developments more.
Thank you.
Other questions for Dr. Berner? Seeing none, Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee send Dr. Berner's appointment to the floor of the Senate with the recommendation that the Senate give its consent and approval to his appointment.
To that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, just before
members,
you do that, I'd like to
Senator Vickerman.
I'd like to second that.
I'll third it.
Alfred has always helped us. Alfred knows more about the LCC than I do when I was the chair.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, Senator. Thank you.
Let the record show that Senator Vickerman has seconded that motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
We'll move to the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. Julie Gehring. Ms. Gehring, welcome to the committee and to the confirmation hearing, and we would just ask that you identify yourself and give us a little background.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Julie Gehring, and I live in Moorhead, and I was born and raised in Alexandria and grew up around the lakes, and I've always been interested and concerned about the environment, and I also work for a environmental group that works between Minnesota, North Dakota, and Manitoba, so I've been there for 24 years. And so water and environmental issues are my interest.
Ms. Gehring, as a public relations specialist, what kind of projects did you have your hand on?
Mr. Chair, we the Red River Basin Commission works with actually North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Manitoba. So we have several projects that work on the Red River, which flows north. So there's a lot of unique issues with obviously flooding and water supply, water quality issues. So the Basin Commission has worked on I several hundreds of projects over the last 24 years, just trying to coordinate the efforts of the state agencies, the local water boards that work on things, just mostly a coordination role in a lot of projects, making sure that they're all working together for the same final product.
Did you work with other public relations specialists from each state and Canada, or were you kind of pulling the wagon yourself there?
Mr. Chair, what the Basin Commission does is we have several committees, and we do work with a lot of the agencies, PR people, and just the DNR, Waters, State Water Commission and North Dakota and Manitoba Water Resources. So we're always coordinating, and I have been kind of the one that does the final product of getting the information out, but it's a coordinated effort between all the agencies and organizations in the Red River Basin.
What do you see your role on the Environmental Quality Board being?
Mr. Chair, I see it as it's actually very similar. That's why I was interested in when I first got on a couple years ago, because I think it's similar to what I do in the Red River Basin, but on the state level, it's what the board does is make sure that all the nine agencies that are on the board, that they're all working together, and with the tight budgets, they make sure there's no duplication of efforts, and I just think that it's interesting to watch how they all work together, because each agency could be working toward the same thing, but duplicating, and what the Environmental Quality Board has done is make sure those efforts are all coordinated, and that's kind of what I do on my regular job, so I find that really interesting that they do the same thing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Goring, living in Moorhead, obviously you deal with floods fairly regular, like at least once a year. Then there's been some talk about pooling water, trying to hold water back. I think I might have even asked you this question before, but do you see that as an advantage at all when it comes to the environmental quality at all, or helping out helping out in general? I know the water, you know, rarely runs north, but at the Red River it does, and it can be, I mean, the river can be 11 miles wide in places. I know that from experience from coming from that neck of the woods. And I know there's talk about, and I know there's been a lot of work and a lot of time expended on trying to pull that water back. Is that still a very big challenge, or do you see you have some experience with that
yes,
in the
Mr.
basin there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, right now that's definitely one of the things that is being worked on, the retention efforts. And we, the Red River Basin Commission, who I work for, we have a main stem modeling project that we're trying to show in all parts of the Red River Basin, Minnesota, North Dakota, a 20% reduction in flows and where projects could be put that would help do that. And now the big talk is with the diversion that is possibly going to be on the North Dakota side now. There still will be some downstream impacts from that diversion, so we want to try and have some retention projects that can help reduce the flows, and so those people won't be impacted as a result of the diversion.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, what's the challenges there? Landowners, obviously, that's the big one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, that's one of the big challenges is the landowners and getting them...
Get rid of their water.
Yep. There's a lot of people that won't be losing their property and their farms, but it's also the whole PR of letting them know how this is going to benefit, and it can also benefit them. A lot of them have a land elsewhere that will be a lot better land because of the diversion, but that's going to be a long process selling that.
Thanks.
We've put fair amount of money into the Reinvest in Minnesota program, and some of it has been designated towards flood hazard mitigation. Is that appropriate for the Red River Basin?
Mr. Chair, yes, that has been used a lot by the Red River Basin.
Okay. So would more help?
Mr. Chair, I believe it would. I believe that's a good program.
Thank you. Mayor Rickerman?
I move this nomination.
Okay. All right. Mr. Scogan, you've got the language there.
Senator Rickerman, Mr. Chair, would move that the committee recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Julie Goering as the public member of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Garrett. All right. I've got a long list for the Clean Water Council. If this is okay to proceed this way, would the folks who are being reappointed, if you've already served a term or more, would you please come up to the table first? Meaning you've been confirmed, and then you're here for reconfirmation. Maybe we could get a fourth chair up there, too.
There we go.
Yeah.
Why don't we go left to right, introduce yourselves, and if you wouldn't mind mentioning which spot you represent, because you represent certain organizations or interests, and then a brief introduction of why you'd like to be on the Clean Water Council. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I'm Scott Hazy. I represent the statewide farm organizations. I've served on the council for the last 3 years, I think it is now, when the inception of the council started. So I truly like being serving on the council. I think it's great. I learn things there, and plus I'm there to teach other members of the council what farm organizations do too, and what their interest is on clean water.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swackhammer. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I serve the seat that is reserved for higher education. I am the director of the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota, and I'm trained as a water chemist. And so my interest in the Clean Water Council is both from a technical perspective and also to represent higher education. I've served on the council for the last 3 years, since its inception, and would be pleased to be able to serve again. Thank you.
Senators, my name is Pam Blixt, and I currently am the representative for watershed districts on the council. I am an appointed member of the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, and I have served on that board for about 15 years and on the Clean Water Council for the last 3 years since we all began together. And in my professional work, my day job is working for the City of Minneapolis in public health preparedness. And my interest in serving on the council is really to bring more light to civic engagement and to ensure that we have local units of government represented in the mix, and to continue the work that we have done for the last 3 years. I think one of the issues that we all have is because we only work together once a month, and this is, as you know, a complex area that we all have a long learning curve to get up to speed on. I think it's important to retain some continuity on the council, and I think we're all here to help do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my name is Stephen Peterson. I'm a senior staff scientist with Daily Systems.
Mr. Peterson, would you mind repeating that with the microphone a little closer to you?
Move it. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Stephen Peterson. I'm a senior staff scientist with BAE Systems here in Minneapolis. I also have a broad base of experience starting out with DNR and the Soil and Water Board years ago on water planning and land use planning, and wanted to bring that information together. I serve as the business community with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce representative to the council, and bring the industry perspective, much like Scott with his agricultural perspective, on what we're doing in the area of enhancing the water resource in the state of Minnesota, and how we can continue to work as an organization together. I mean, I think the single seminal event that has occurred with the Clean Water Council is that we, in fact, focus on water resources to almost the exclusion of everything else, And with that focus, we bring both diverse views and areas of expertise that help both the agencies and the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blix, this may go beyond your work with the Clean Water Council, but I'm curious, up in my district, there's some consideration of trying to create a new watershed district up there, and I'm just wondering your perspective on the work they do, if we have enough, if we need more, what your recommendations might be to some town boards that are thinking about trying to create one.
Blixt.
I'm sorry, Senator, I can't see your name. It's down at the end there.
Scogan. It's fine.
Scogan. Senator Scogan, Mr. Chairman. I think every part of the state and every area is different in terms of what works and what won't work. And since I'm not familiar, I don't even know where you're from. I think one of the things that I found that's really great about watershed districts per se is that it is a local unit of government, and by statute it's given a lot of tools to get work done. And so I think it's a very effective, it can be very effective if the group that's appointed, and they are appointed by county commissioners, if they are doing given the tools, they can do a really good job at the local level. But not all watershed districts necessarily are given the same amount of tools because they are their taxing capacity is going to be different based on the size of the district and the amount of property that may be taxed. So it's really hard for me to say specifically without knowing for your particular district. But they are can be and very effective units of getting work done in this particular area.
So, Mr. Chair, follow-up for Ms. Blix, then. Size isn't really a part of the equation. It's other things that would tell us if they're going to be successful or not?
Well, size does obviously impact the amount of taxing capacity that a district would have, and it is using that tax capacity whereby they can actually get some of the work done. So depending on the size of the district and the property tax availability, that's going to make a difference. But also, there are a number of other factors depending on who gets appointed to the board and the citizens who are there, because a lot of times watersheds are developed and created usually by petitions of local citizens. That's how they're created, and it's because there are particular issues going on in particular areas, so citizens generally have an interest in making sure that they're effective, and if they continue the work to monitor the watersheds themselves, then I think they can be very effective.
Thank you.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, and to the four of you, since you've been working on this council for 3 years, are there any changes that you would recommend to the council, either expansion of your roles or where a role that you don't think you should be working in, or changes you would like to see in the role of advising the legislature and the governor that you have?
Sir Steve.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the role that we're really, I believe, growing into now, I believe is very important, is the issue of, measurement of outcomes. Are we spending our money on the right projects at the right time? We spent a long time working with the agency and other members of the council, PCA, and other agencies on the concept of a watershed approach for the water planning portion and the TMDL management in the state. And I believe this group really helped that happen. And it was one of the coalescing areas that have begun to bring us together so that we can move on what Pam was saying, the engagement portion, how we can begin to bring the private sector, if you will, more involved in water planning. That's the one area we see as really a necessary next move. And then this concept of measurement of outcomes. Are we spending the state's money on the right thing at the right time and the right benefits?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peterson, and you're able to do that within the framework that you have in place now. You don't need changes from the legislature in the enacting law?
I don't believe we need changes. I believe it's our role coming together.
Okay, thank you.
Would others like to weigh in?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I do think that the Council and there's some confusion, if not tension, between the role of the Clean Water Council and its role vis-a-vis the Clean Water Fund. And I think it would be a terrific thing if the legislature did address this confusion. And one of the specifics, for instance, is that the Clean Water Fund and the legacy amendment really also focused on drinking water issues and would involve the Department of Health. And the Clean Water Council does not have representation from the Department of Health. So that's an example where an expansion or a slight change in the mission of the Clean Water Council would benefit the state by just addressing that issue. If we're going to deal with water, we should deal with water as one thing, one hydrosphere.
Explain that confusion, Dr. Slackhammer.
Sorry. Couldn't see who was speaking.
Explain that confusion.
Mr. Chair, we were the Clean Water Council was created under the Clean Water Legacy Act, and then there's some confusion as to whether the Clean Water Council then has any role to play or what the role should be that it plays in advising the legislature on the Clean Water Fund from the legacy amendment to the Constitution.
Well, there is no statutory authority given to the Clean Water Council to make recommendations on the Clean Water Fund. So where is the confusion?
The confusion lies in that, Mr. Chair, that some folks think that might be the case, that the Clean Water Council does have a role to play in advising on the spending of the Clean Water Fund, when in fact we were created to advise on the Clean Water Legacy Fund.
Okay. But is the Clean Water Council confused about that role?
No, I think that they are not confused. I think there is a desire on some members to play more of a value-added role in advising the legislature. But I don't think that role is well articulated. And, in fact, in my reading of the statute is that it's not there at all. So I just think it would be helpful if the legislature were to clarify that.
Because when we were considering clean water funding appropriations, the Clean Water Council was pretty forthright in its recommendations and gave us, the legislature, pretty clear recommendations about where the appropriation should go. So I don't understand how the council could be confused. Either it feels like it has a role and therefore made appropriations recommendations, or does not feel like it has a role and did not and would not have. So maybe the council feels like it has a right, and that's fine. It is, I think it's your right actually to consider how the money should be spent. It would not make sense if you ignored it. But I don't understand the statement that there is confusion over the role, because there's clearly no statutory authority.
Mr. Chair, when I said there is confusion, I probably should have specified who there was. I don't believe that the council is confused, and yes, I believe they, if I could speak for the council, we felt it was our right to comment, not our statutory authority to comment. It was our right to comment.
All right.
When I say there is confusion, I mean in the greater community. Many people think we are supposed to be commenting on the Clean Water Fund. I meant in the greater community, not within the council itself. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So then building upon that, would you folks favor statutory authority for the Clean Water Council to make official recommendations on the Clean Water Fund appropriations. Ms. Blix?
I would say I think that's a good role for the council to make recommendations to the legislature for your consideration. Yes.
Mr. Hess?
Hazy, excuse me.
Hazy, I apologize.
Okay. I think, too, it would probably help clarify some of our boundaries, what we have. You know, I think if we have clarification where we can recommend and where we suggest, I guess, you know. So I think it would help our council.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, I think it's very important, though, that the council be that the membership of the council be reconsidered in the sense of including the Department of Health officially and including expanding the mission to consider the aspects of the Clean Water, the legacy amendment mission, to include drinking water and to include groundwater supplies. Right now, the Clean Water Council does not have it's not in our mission to consider those two aspects of water.
Yes, some of the, you know, the structure of the council itself would probably have to be reworked a tad. That were to be the case. Mr. Peterson, do you agree as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
Let me ask you this, then, building upon that even further. What are your opinions regarding the Clean Water Fund's appropriations in terms of focusing on TMDL's assessments versus putting money on the ground, so to speak, for actual cleanup? Should a majority be spent on clean water assessments, impairment assessments, or should there be a mix? Mr. Hesse.
My feeling is it should be a mix, I guess. You know, that should be determined every year, or by and biannual at least, you know, determine where the money should go. I think for the council, I think we have the capability of doing that. I think we work closely with other agencies and stuff, so, and we have advisors on the board, so I think that could be determined biannually where the money should go.
So then what type of cleanup activities would you favor?
Personally, ag, I guess, you know, because I represent ag, but I think, you know, there's so much projects to clean up out there, and the money's not sure enough. So we could start someplace like PCA is doing now, other agencies are doing now, but the money is never enough there to do the whole job completely, so it's an ongoing process.
Well, on the ag issue, I think it's very important to, you know, educate us on what forms of addressing pollution, in your opinion, would be best.
I think the feedlot issues right now, I think we have the rules that are supposed to go into effect this year, all that feedlots are supposed to be cleaned up, and I think that's not going to happen because of the shortage of money. So I think there's one area we could start. There's other issues. There's probably septics on the farm, too, that need cleaning up that the landowner feels, well, no one sees it, so it's out of sight, out of mind. So, and I think that's an issue right there, that we could spend money on that. It'll take a lot of money to clean these issues up. So, and you know, you mentioned earlier in a committee today about the rim and stuff like that. I think we need more buffers along ditches and stuff like that, too, would help, you know, preserve our water and clean up our water.
So do you think that you might be an advocate for recommendations out of the Clean Water Council for more funding for RIM in the next round of funding?
Well, I'm always an advocate for that, being on the Soil and Water Board and stuff for 10 years. I think I'm an advocate of that. Anything we can do that would improve the water quality.
That was one of the questions I had about the previous recommendations from the Clean Water Council, that there was no recommendations for funding RIM. And it's one thing that I emphasized, and I'd like to emphasize to you folks today as well, that for the next round of funding, I really encourage the Clean Water Council, whatever recommendations it comes up with, to include RIM as well as aquatic management areas. Did any others want to respond? And Mr. Yeah. Peterson?
To address what you were talking about, Mr. Chair, on the relationship of TMDLs and projects on the ground and planning, the new 10-year plan for looking at completing all of the watershed districts and getting TMDLs set on a watershed basis is an excellent beginning to have good planning, to get focused TMDLs, to get our money spent properly on the ground. but there needs to very definitely be a transition from planning to projects. You can't keep planning. And I think we have a lot of information, and that planning phase needs to give away to projects sooner rather than later. And your RIM statement is very real on how you begin to look at that on a basis of agriculture, but also, you know, as we're looking with the Metropolitan Waste Control and the monies that are going out to the point sources as well.
Mr. Chair, I would also be an advocate for a mixed portfolio of spending. I just wanted to share with you I'm teaching a graduate class in water policy at the university right now, and it happens to be the essay question I have just assigned to my students is justify how you would spend if you were in charge of the Clean Water Fund, how much of it should go to restoration versus protection. So I'm happy to share my students' results with you at the end of the class.
Please let us know who got the A's.
Not that they'd be biased by my perspective, right. But
teacher gets Ms. Blake.
I think the point that I would make about, because I agree with them, there should be a mix, but I think we are going to be in a continuum, as Mr. Peterson pointed out, that we are in the beginning of doing a lot of the assessment work that needs to be done. But as time goes by, the need for assessment hopefully will be reduced, and we'll be able to change our mix to include more on-the-ground work. But right now there are some projects that we've completed the assessments for and that we are going to be able to and should be doing the work for now to get real change already started. And it's just going to – I think there's going to be a gradually, a continuum in terms of where we spend our money. At least that's my hope, that over time we'll be able to increase and get to some of the real work that produces change for everybody.
Dill?
Mr. Chair, members, I think we have four very excellent candidates here, but I just want to mention Scott Hazy specifically a little bit because his farm used to be in my Senate district, and I've been on it several times. His father was a county commissioner. He's been active in many organizations, and including president of the Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation District. In Carver County, I've toured their environmental projects, and it's a very active county in terms of doing things to help protect the environment. Scott Hazy's provided excellent leadership, and he has a very nice farm, and I really just wanted the committee to know that he's a well-qualified individual. I'm sure all of you are, and I endorse all of you, but I just wanted to mention Scott, especially since I've had a special relationship with him.
Senator Dibble, let's
move this. We're giving our nominating, our seconding speech. I just wanted to commend Pam Blixt to the committee. If you look at her submittal, and I think folks are familiar with her because, of course, she's been in front of the committee before, but she's been at the Minnehaha Creek Watershed Districts for how long now? Long time, 1993?
Forever.
Yeah. And has also chaired the Metropolitan Watershed Association's for quite a while, doesn't presently chair it, but chaired it from 2005 up until now, and has really worked hard for a long, long time in an urban context, an urban setting on a lot of very complicated watershed, surface water, groundwater issues. I'm familiar with Pam from my time going back to working for the Minneapolis City Council and a lot of initiatives that we addressed jointly along with the DNR and a bunch of others, and we've seen tremendous improvement in water quality particularly in our surface water system, our chain of lakes, and her list is very long of civic service, particularly related to these issues. So she's uniquely qualified to continue her service in this capacity as well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're making sort of second speeches, I would like to commend Dr. Swackhammer for all the work she has done for the state of Minnesota and specifically for the LCCMR. For the members who do not serve on the LCCMR, Dr. Swackhammer has appeared before our commission several times, given us very valuable insight, and done a lot of work for our programs there. So thank you, Dr. Swackhammer.
Thank you, Senator.
Dr. Swackhammer, would you be at all willing to give this committee a refresher on the statewide conservation plan at some point?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that. The statewide conservation and preservation plan was completed about a year and a half ago as a result of a request by the LCCMR and the legislature.
I guess I didn't mean today.
No, I was just explaining what it was.
Okay.
For the. I saw some puzzled looks,
I thought I would just
explain it was. I'd be happy to come in and do that. And also on the statewide water sustainability framework, which, again, the legislature has asked us to prepare. Thank you.
Great. Mr. Bennett here?
He's not here today.
Okay. All right. I think Senator Dibble beat you on the call for the motion.
Are we moving all four as a
as
a whole? Okay. Then, Mr. Chair, I would make the appropriate motion.
You want me to read it?
That'd be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble.
To make sure you got the words right now.
Senator Dibble moves that this committee recommends that the Senate confirm the appointments of Pamela Blix, representing watershed districts, Scott Hazy, representing a statewide farm organization, Stephen Peterson, representing a business organization, and Dr. Deborah Swackhammer, representing the state's higher education system, to the Clean Water Council.
Mr. Chair, I accept any and all seconders.
A discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With your work. Okay, so Mr. Bennett was not
here.
That's fine. So then we'll take Mr. Hansen, Miriam, Ms. Reinhardt, Renville, and Mr. Howe. I think we might need an extra chair.
Slide down that way, I think a little bit. You'll have to slide that way. Oops, sorry. Yeah, because we've got that paperwork in front.
Thank you for making room up there.
What were the four names we just did?
We'll go right to left this time. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gene Merriam from Coon Rapids. And have been on the committee about 6 months now. I represent a position representing environmental organizations. I have a part-time position with the Freshwater Society. I'm also on the board of directors of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the Minnesota chapter of the National Audubon Society, and Conservation Minnesota. I have a long and involvement in water issues, including my 22 years on this in this august body, serving on this committee and its forerunners, as well as a number of other organizations before and subsequent, and of course my 4 years as Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Keith Hansen. I'm representing the business community, and I'm out of the Duluth office of Bar Engineering. I compliment what Mr. Peterson does. He gives a different perspective than what I look at. I look at primarily the mining, the electric utilities, and the pulp and paper industry's business impacts on the TMDL, or Total Maximum Daily Load Program. My long tenure at Minnesota Power, now at Bar Engineering, and in my involvement with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce as the Water Quality Subcommittee, I've been fortunate enough to participate in a number of different policy and regulatory forums addressing the Total Maximum Daily Load Program. So I bring a long-standing perspective to the Clean Water Council along those lines. I've also been fortunate enough to work with a diverse group of stakeholders, much as the Clean Water Council, in developing consensus-type recommendations. So I think that's one of the strengths that I bring to the council.
Hi, I'm Victoria Reinhardt, Ramsey County Commissioner, and I currently serve as Vice Chair of the Clean Water Council. I have actually been on the council for about a year and a half. I am representing, through the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Metropolitan County Commissioner, and so it's a very limited pool. But I believe that one of the reasons that I was appointed to it, to fill out a term of someone who had left, was because of my long background and experience in the environmental field, primarily in garbage or solid waste management, dealing with product stewardship, toxicity reduction, recycling. That goes back to the mid-'80s. On a national level and on a local level, I have served in many leadership capacities regarding solid waste management. Most recently, I have also served on the National Association of Counties Executive Committee regarding air quality. So water was something that was relatively new to me when I came onto the Clean Water Council. But the reality is, whether you're talking about the environmental impacts of virtually anything that happens, it's land, air, it's water. And so the experience that I had in solid waste management, and especially in toxicity reduction, pharmaceuticals, waste pharmaceuticals, I know is an issue that you've been dealing with recently as well. Clearly, there is an impact on water, and that's the primary perspective that I bring to the Clean Water Council. And this is my first confirmation hearing, and so I'm finding it very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Hi.
My name is John Howe. I'm the mayor of Red Wing, Minnesota. I grew up in western Minnesota by Morse, where my folks still live. Grew up on a farm out there, and my wife and I own a farm out there that's all into CREP, and also some of it's into REM. I'm here to represent the as a representative for cities. And being in Red Wing, I think we obviously have the Mississippi River that runs alongside our community, and we have concerns with Lake Pepin. But geographically, I'd be representing southeastern Minnesota on the board also. I think that's one of the things they look at. But for me, clean water not only is a issue for the well-being and the health of our citizens, but I think it's vital to our economic interest for our state. And I've only been on the council a short time, and I know we talk about where we need to look at funding and spending our dollars. I believe that protection and prevention goes a long ways in a return on investment, because it's much easier or more efficient to protect some of our waterways and some of our water bodies than it is to repair the impediments. Once they're impaired, we're going to spend a lot more money trying to restore that water quality. So it's been very interesting, and I thought the questions from the reconfirmation hearings was very appropriate. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name's Todd Renville, and I was appointed to serve under the statewide hunting organizations. By day, I work as an environmental scientist with URS Corporation. I lead our local environmental resources practice. But my interest in serving on the council is sort of the intersection of that science based experience with my passion, which is outdoor pursuits, hunting, conservation. I'd be pleased to serve on this council moving forward.
Let me bounce off some of the questions we asked the earlier folks. How would you appropriate the next round of the Clean Water Fund?
Well, I have a particular interest with civic engagement, and I think one of the biggest things we need to do is look towards educating the public for the prevention of the degradation of some of our water quality. I also think that the Water Council or the Clean Water Council should be concerned with groundwater contamination and degradation of our groundwater situation. So I think civic engagement and education of our citizenry is real important to get that message out.
And
Ms. Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would agree with that. And when we brought forward recommendations last year regarding the Clean Water Fund, we really did try to zero in on or focus on some of the prevention aspects not just of waters that are already impaired, but how do you stop the degradation before it gets so far that you don't have much of a chance. So the prevention and protection side are very important.
Mr. Chair, the senators, I would also agree with what has been discussed previously in that this is a continuum that we're going to have to deal with. And as I think as we move through the watershed process, the level of funding that goes into protection and restoration is going to increase. And I believe right now it is at about 45 or 50% of the recommendations that's been put forth in the council. So I think as we go through time, that will that'll move higher into that category. I also think groundwater and the drinking water component is something that we need to seriously consider as we continue in our deliberations.
Mr. Merriam?
Mr. Chairman, I would observe a couple of things. One is I have serious misgivings about the degree to which we're allocating resources to the TMDL process. I'm not convinced it's going to lead to significant changes in water quality. I'm convinced that we're following the law as the EPA and the Congress has given it to us, and we need to do that to a certain extent. But they tell me that we're further ahead than most states. I think that we have to be serious about making differences on the ground. And I think in doing that, we have to focus those resources. You know, I was struck hearing a presentation almost a couple of years ago now, and I think it's been borne out by Professor Peter Nowak at the University of Wisconsin that talks about our efforts in our cost-sharing programs as random acts of conservation. That we need to be doing is to make sure that we're putting the money where it's going to make the biggest difference as opposed to spreading it around the countryside to whoever is a willing participant. I visited with John Jasky at Bowser and talked about this, and they talks about how they're trying to make a better effort, and I believe they are. But I think it's something that all of you as well as us are going to have to focus on with greater effort.
Well, I agree, and I think here, just from my own point of view, I support the cost share, and I think we need to do some of that. I think there's a importance that it lends to improving or changing the culture of agricultural practices. But as far as the TMDL goes, I personally agree. I don't think we should stop, but I think we ought to get going on where we know waters are polluted and use the money effectively. So I appreciate your comments. Others? Oh, I'm Mr. Renville.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, I would like to see funding that leverages some of the other activities out there. The Lessard Sams Council certainly is doing some things on the habitat side that have a clean water benefit. And some of our recommendations, I believe, should address some of those issues. And consequently, the Lessard Sams, perhaps contingent funding, if there's something that has a clean water benefit, but also a habitat side, that the two appropriations are somehow considered together.
Who's first? Senator Dill and then
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I'm just making an observation here. I've sat here for 18 years going through recommendations and confirming appointments and so forth, and I always see this question here in the application. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? And I don't think I've ever seen anybody answer yes, yes. So in all fairness, so we don't discriminate against any special group, it seems like somewhere in the system we should at least appoint one felon. So we demonstrate to the public that we are, in fact, willing to give people a second chance.
A free observation from a future retired legislator.
Yeah, there you go.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was really good, Senator Dill. There's been some talk of all of you about the input that you have with regards to the Clean Water Legacy Fund in 2008. And Ms. Reinhart, you said that you made recommendations, or the group made recommendations last year. About how many, or what percentage of those recommendations were actually implemented in statute last year? Because I know that was a two-year funding cycle.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbrechtson. As we were up here at the legislature and following what was happening with your deliberations, I don't know the exact percentage. I do know that we felt very good about the outcome of the legislation and felt that our recommendations not only had been heard, but generally had been followed. So I hesitate to say 100% because I'm sure it wasn't, but we felt very good about the input, about the fact that senators and representatives really listened to what we had to say when we came up to testify.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Engelbrechtson, I certainly think it was above 90% of what they recommended was written into law. Yep. And part of the difference is the legacy constitutional amendment mandates 5% for drinking water, and the Clean Water Legacy Council does not make recommendations for the drinking water. So most of the recommendations were heeded.
Someone else had their hand up. I didn't get a chance to ask the other group this, but should the Clean Water Council at all discuss and consider, and you maybe even propose anything on the human impact on climate change, the human contribution to climate change?
What's he trying to do?
Would folks like to comment on that? Mr. Renville?
Mr. Chair, the short answer is I'm not sure. I don't know. I truly haven't thought about the implications of climate change on this very fairly narrow technical area. Honest answer.
Mr. Howe?
Mr. Chair and Senators, that's a good question. I think obviously we have certain industries that do consume large amounts of water resources, and so I think I think when you're looking at a global picture, everyone says that clean water, fresh water in particular, is going to be a very valuable resource down the road. I'm not sure that the Clean Water Council of the state of Minnesota would have the capacity or the technical expertise to address that issue.
What about climate change, Mr. Howe?
Again, I think it might be something that one of the committees might be able to address, but again, I'm not sure that we possess, at least I know I don't possess the technical aspects. Certainly, I think that's probably stretching our ability on the Clean Water Council.
What are your views on climate change?
Well, could you define that for me?
Does it exist? And have humans contributed to it?
You know, I think that globally there's been cycles of change. You know, when you look at the history of the Earth, thousands of years of change. I'm certain that certain industries lend itself to using larger resources than others. I don't know the technical aspect of how that's going to affect the actual global climate change in our society. So I don't believe that I have the technical expertise to comment on that.
Ms. Reinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. Well, as a follow-up to that last question, I absolutely believe that there's human causes, obviously, for climate change and that we need to do something now. And I believe that the science, even though I am not a scientist, backs that up. And so without going into too much detail on that, we need to take action. And to me, it's as simple as that. As I said at the beginning of my comments, the issues, when you're talking about environmental issues, are so interconnected. Solid waste management does have an impact on clean water. Is the Clean Water Council going to specifically deal with those aspects of the environmental impacts? Probably not. Are they? Do we need to be aware of them? Yes, we do. So as far as the Clean Water Council, I think that our role is pretty well defined in how it relates to recommendations regarding clean water. And there are some aspects of that that are clearly part of climate change, but probably not the main focus of what the Clean Water Council would deal with. But again, it's all interconnected. And if we try to just deal with a very narrow area of the environmental field, it really doesn't work well. So I think we do need to keep an open mind.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I would also agree with what Todd and Victoria said about the have said about the ability of the council to address those issues. I know from my own personal background that if we get into that type of discussion, I know I'm not the right person to be at that table. So if that role would be expanded into that capacity, I think we need to look in a different direction. Personally, I agree that, yes, there are interconnections between global climate, hazardous waste, solid waste disposal, and all that. And I think that right now the council has got all it can handle and grapple with is to come up with these recommendations on funding and also provide the agencies with some recommendations as to where their programs should be going. So that would be my take at this point.
Senator?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have much to add to that. I would certainly observe that it's, I think the science is pretty overwhelming, the impact of humankind on global warming or climate change. Exactly what that means for the near term rather than the far term, I'm not sure. It seems to be the consensus we're going to see our precipitation events come in greater storm events, not perhaps changing the amount of precipitation the state of Minnesota gets, but altering the occurrence events into having greater, more significant precipitation events. What that means for the Clean Water Council and its role, I don't have a connection to make with that at this point.
Well, something to consider would be if the council is interested in making recommendations on drinking water and groundwater, their climate change may lead to less of it.
That's very true.
Okay. Further discussion? Any other questions? Mr. Howe, I have a kind of a difficult question to ask you. Is it true that you are also a candidate for office?
Mr. Chair and Senators, that would be a correct statement.
Has that been for quite a while?
As a mayor.
Since the first of the year. Actually, since December 31st of last year.
Right. One of the issues that we've run into on the Clean Water Council is that one of the people that we confirmed ran for office and became elected to the House of Representatives and is currently filling a citizen's spot on the council, and has apparently declined to resign. So I'm getting increasingly concerned about the precedent that's being set with folks running for office and then becoming appointed to the council. You're not the only person. There's another individual under our consideration who was not able to attend today. So given all that, I'm really struggling with that aspect.
Mr. Chair and Senators, let me bring some clarity to that issue. I would be representing the cities. I would be a representative of the cities. If I was so fortunate to join your ranks, I would certainly resign from the Clean Water Council. So I would clear up any issue on that. However, if that doesn't, if I'm not that fortunate to join your ranks, I will certainly fill out my term on the Clean Water Council.
Either way he's at. So we'll see him next year. Next time. We won't be leaving.
Okay. Still struggling with it. Let me move to another question. What I talked about earlier is what do you folks think the role should be of the Clean Water Council in terms of recommending the appropriations on the Clean Water Fund? Should we change the statute so that the Clean Water Council has a official capacity similar to perhaps the Lessard-Sams Council?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I know I'm new on the council, but I think that would be an appropriate decision to make.
Mr. Renville?
Mr. Chair, Senators, I would be in favor of that also.
I would agree.
I would also agree.
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, make it unanimous.
Sounds good. And I don't know. I don't know if I'd disagree with that. Dr. Swackhammer mentioned that if that were to be the case, there would probably have to be appropriate adjustments to some of the membership. And we've talked about putting legislators on Clean Water Council regardless. There probably ought to be a more RFP-type process. But
probably make them public officials, too.
Pardon?
Probably make them public
officials. Oh, they would have officially be public officials? Yeah. But, you know, I don't know if I necessarily have a problem with that. Just wanted to get your opinion. Senator Dibble?
Thanks. I think time is drawing nigh here, and I think we have another committee waiting to use our room, so I just wanted to make my seconding speeches, if I could. I know Commissioner Reinhart quite well and have for quite some time in her capacity as commissioner on the Ramsey Board of Ramsey County Board, I'm most familiar with her work around transit and housing issues, and again, her resume I think speaks for itself and very well, and her work around solid waste issues particularly. I think she's uniquely and eminently qualified, and probably don't have to speak about Senator Merriam all that much. We all know him extremely well, and have been very grateful for his service and his expertise, and most recently on water issues and clean water issues. And so I'm especially thrilled. And then, of course, Mr. Renville is my constituent, and I'm looking at his resume. I don't know him very well, but look forward. And a neighbor, actually. I live at 39th and Garfield. I see you live at 40th and Colfax, so just a couple blocks away. Always proud to support and nominate someone from Senate District, the fine District of 60 in Southwest Minneapolis. And, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to echo, I'm uncomfortable with the mayor's candidacy for this particular body, particularly serving in a capacity that advises the legislature. It seems to introduce an element of politics specific to the work that we're doing here that is not necessarily value added. In other capacities, in his capacity as mayor working with the League of Minnesota Cities, et cetera, that's you know, that's a different question. And, you know, in the commissioner's service, you know, in her capacity as a county commissioner not running for the Senate, you know, there's some, it just, there's an overlap here that is uncomfortable for me.
Senator Albertson, did you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this kind of puts us in a rather rare situation, this idea of, singling somebody out because they're doing their what they all have a right to do, and that's run for public office. And I guess I can't echo those concerns. In fact, the matter is the mayor is from a city that borders a lot of water and should be concerned about water and has a lot of expertise in that regards, and I'm sure he takes a lot of input and will be taking input and open to taking input from all the mayors in the state of Minnesota, should he prevail or should he not prevail in his election. So I really have no problem. I don't know that there's going to be very many meetings between now and November. I'm not sure exactly how many there are, but I certainly have no problem whatsoever, and I don't care what party they're from. Should they be running as a Democrat or as a Republican or independent, showing their wanting to serve on here, and obviously being a member from the cities of the state of Minnesota, I think that says something.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to echo Senator Dibble's comments on the mayor. I just think that we need to keep the politics off of these boards for right now, and I think we have in the past, and we have a tradition of not having elected officials or candidates on it, so I'd just like to stay consistent with our traditions here.
And I mean, we have spots for elected officials. I don't think that's the issue. I think the concern is that someone becomes a candidate and then becomes appointed to the council. It's just I'm uncomfortable with that too. Senator Dilt.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, is there any rules or regulations or anything? If there's any ethics considerations or anything in state law, regulation, anything that would say that a person is appointed to a position by the Senate or by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, that they are not allowed to run for a public office?
Senator Dill, no.
There's any statute of that.
So if Mr. Howe had not made a decision to run yet, and there's still plenty of time for candidates to come forward because the filings are quite a ways off, of a couple of months at least, or whatever it is, people that are appointed, well, everybody at the table up there actually could choose to run. And the fact that Mr. Howell made the decision at the end of last year, I would be uncomfortable if we did not confirm or recommend confirmation on him.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Howell, you're representing cities. How were you selected to represent cities on the council?
Mr. Howell.
I'm concerned about clean water. I actually seen the vacancy there, and I applied for the position. So, when I talk about water usage, I had a conversation with one of the senators about water usage, and we've got some big users of resource of waters. I haven't particularly advocated just for our Red Wing. You know, I'm concerned about the water quality for all Minnesotans, and in fact, recently, last year, at the beginning of last year, I made recommendations for appointments for a 15-member sustainability commission in the city of Red Wing. One of the things that Red Wing has done is a sewer separation project, and we've also identified all the storm sewers that drain directly to the river. We've also initiated a stormwater utility fee for all of our residents in the city of Red Wing. So, like I said before, I certainly will fulfill the duties on the Clean Water Council, but if for some reason, you know, I get elected to some other higher office, I certainly will resign this position. But I don't think we can. I hope you don't make decisions on what if, because there's no guarantees in life. And I certainly want to serve the state of Minnesota and the residents, and I want to serve you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more concern, or one question maybe to run off of Senator Dill's question with regards to being concerned or rules or regulations of who sits on and serves on committees. Is there anything in statute or any policy saying that somebody who has served in the legislature, such as the good senator that's sitting on the board now, be appointed? I mean, if there's a problem with any ramifications of any political beliefs or whatever, one would be concerned about that as well, I would suppose. So, and I'm certainly not with Senator Merriam, and obviously his record tells that. It shows that he is an exemplary member that we have on this committee. So I would be real careful if we're going to be doing these kind of things. Just a comment.
Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think you're right. We ought to be very, very careful. Over the last 4 years, we have we've never rejected a confirmation in this committee. And so I think we've been very careful about examining everyone very carefully, and that's one of the things that I began doing when I started becoming chair is beginning a thorough questioning of all of our appointees, regardless of position. And we probably, and regardless of party, we probably confirmed more Republicans out of this committee than Democrats. And frankly, party affiliation has never been a concern in this committee. It has always been about qualifications. We've done a little bit of due diligence. We've asked people in charge of appointments for past Democratic administrations, Republican administrations, as well as Ventura's administration, and we could not find an example where someone had been appointed to a position after they had become a candidate for the legislature or some other office. And I think we have to be careful about that, too. I think we have to be very careful about that type of precedent as well. That's my concern. And it's not something personal against Mr. Howe. I think he's probably serves diligently as the mayor of Red Wing. We also in this committee have to be concerned about the Clean Water Council as well as all the other boards that we appoint. And we've done so, and there hasn't been an example in the last 4 years where we've rejected anyone, let alone based on party affiliation. I think this is just one of those times where the issue stands out. Senator Sieben?
Mr. Chair, did this committee or did the Senate confirm Representative Torkelson recently to the Clean Water Council?
I apologize, I didn't hear
that. When did the legislature confirm Representative Torkelson? And, I mean, is he coming before the committee as an do we need to confirm his appointment still? Because
no, he will not be reappointed until, I think, a couple years from now.
He's already been confirmed?
Yes.
Because
nor was he a candidate at the time of confirmation.
Before he was elected.
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the case of Mr. Howe, is there any other reason for not confirming him other than he's a candidate for public office? And if that is the reason, could you explain more clearly why that is a reason not to confirm him?
You're asking for my opinion on Mr. Howe's background on this issue. I think it is, my own opinion is that it's thin. When you look at all of the other resumes that we've seen, there has been either a fair or high degree of background on these issues. Not that that is a necessity, because I think Mr. Howe fills an appointment for the city representative, which I think is important. To the issue of why being a candidate is an issue in this case, I think we need to be careful in the legislature about whether people are being appointed for political reasons or whether they're being appointed to serve an actual purpose. And the confluence of Mr. Howe's candidacy and appointment are just a little too recent for comfort, in my opinion. I know others disagree, but those are my views. It's nothing personal towards him. And whatever happens in November, if he wins, he'll have a lot of, in just a few short months, he'll have the opportunity to work on all these issues and more regarding clean water. And if he doesn't, he could fill an appointment at that time. Mayor Ingebrigtsen?
One more comment then, off of what Senator Sieben was talking about, Representative Torkelson. Has Representative Torkelson still sits on this board?
Yes.
And if he does, has he offered to step down?
No.
Climbed.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the point I'm trying to make here is that I think we have a sincere commitment on Mayor Howe's part that should he become a member of this body, that he would step down. I hold him to his word. I see really no reason why we shouldn't confirm.
Senator Phoebe, then Frederickson.
Mr. Chair, I'm really struggling with this, and I just dropped my phone. Because I do recognize what I think is a sincere statement that if he is elected, he will step down. Following up on Senator Ingebrigtsen's, Representative Torkelson, was he ever asked to resign? I'm having more of a problem with Representative Torkelson being on this council right now, personally. And has he been asked to resign? Is there anything in the rules or a statute that I just don't think that it's appropriate that he's on this council? So I'm struggling with that spot more than this right now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson is one of the state representatives in my Senate district, and he was appointed long before, or not a long time before, but significant amount of time before he realized there was going to be an opening to run for the state representative seat. It was a surprise when Representative Finstead decided not to run and Representative Torkelson decided to run and was successful. Contrary to his being asked to resign from that position, I know he received a lot of encouragement to stay on the council because he represents a farm organization. He farms several hundred acres of farmland in Watonwan County primarily. He's a very good farmer. He's very conscientious. He brings a lot of expertise to the council. So rather than being encouraged to resign, he was encouraged to stay on the council, not because he's a legislator, but because of his expertise and knowledge in agriculture.
Mayor Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If members will bear with me for a moment, I honestly have some concerns as well, but I don't want to hang up the other four candidates. So if the chair would indulge me, I would like to split the ballot and make a motion to confirm the other four, and if we want to continue our discussion about Mr. Howe, I'm willing, but I see four other faces up there that certainly deserve our confirmation, I think, and would like to make that motion.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that this committee does recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Keith Hansen as a business organization representative, Jean Merriam as a representative of environmental organizations, Victoria Reinhardt as a metro area county representative, and Todd Renville as a statewide hunting organization representative to the Clean Water Council.
Discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pearson.
I'll wait till we act upon the motion before us, and then I'd like to.
On this motion, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would have to ask the question of the four. Are any of them planning on running for any public office after today?
Or at this time.
Well, if they had the
if not, I think that should be revealed.
The tutorial has been.
Fair enough.
Distributed widely.
Mr. Chairman, I am can't imagine ever doing that again.
You were here the
I never expected
time.
That one.
That alone, I can vote
Mr.
for
Mr. Chair, senators, no, I do Fire not.
I am happy as a county commissioner, and I'm now up for re-election this year.
That makes you even happier.
Mr. Chair, senators, I am not contemplating running for office.
Managed to keep one other person out of the race. So.
Discussion on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Pearson?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we recommend Mr. Howe for the council. We would adopt them. We would affirm him for the council.
Okay.
I think he has proven his willingness and his wish to be there and can do it. And the city of Red Wing is really tied to that river.
So the Senator Pariseau's motion would go as, would you read that, Senator Scogin? You're doing well.
I believe that Senator Pariseau moves that this committee recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of John Howe to the as a representative of cities to the Clean Water Council.
Correct.
The motion? Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I just want to recommend that next legislative session we clarify the statute and make very clear rules so that we won't, no one will get caught up in this dilemma in the future because it's, you know, it's better for everyone to know what the rules are ahead of time. So just want to say for the record, I think that needs to be done, and I will ensure that it happens personally if we can.
Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, members, picking up on that thought, what we're doing here is we might be doing something retroactive, or there's a thought here we should be doing, putting another standard in place that would eliminate some people from even applying, but that should be done prospectively, not retroactively. So I would urge a yes vote on this motion.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble, then Ingebrigtsen.
I don't think we're doing anything retroactively. We're confirming these candidates, as is our constitutional duty and obligation as senators, and we're exercising our judgment about who should and shouldn't be, and we have entirely within our prerogative to determine that based on any determination we have to inform our. We're not doing anything retroactively. We've expressed our views. We've had a fair discussion. And within each of our status as elected senators, we can make our judgment. We're not doing anything retroactively. I do support Senator Anderson's idea, though, to make this particular issue more clear as a legislative body going forward.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And might I ask Senator Anderson, what statute are we going to clear up?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we could, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think we should say in statute that legislators and candidates for the legislature are not eligible to serve on the Clean Water Council. And, you know, I think, you know, the governor chose to make this appointment without, we don't, many of us think that's maybe inappropriate because it could be used for political purposes. Whether or not Mayor Howe had any intention of that, I don't know. I'm not suggesting he did. But I think there's a concern that it's a bad precedent. And so I think we just need to be clear in the future that that's not, I would like to see that in law.
Sure. Mr. Chair, if I may just follow up with
future governors.
With one just one comment from that, then, being it is not law right now, then I think it behooves us to move ahead here so we don't create a problem. So I would vote for confirmation as well.
And I apologize, Senator Paraso and Mr. Howe. I can't support the motion for the reasons I've said earlier. Further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division? Can we ask for a division on that?
Division has been requested. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Six. All those opposed? On a vote of 6-7, the motion does not prevail. Further discussion? Want to make a motion?
Would a motion then have to be made not to recommend, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Where did I have my own language here?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Howe.
Mr. Chair and Senators, all I can tell you is that I really work very hard on sustainability issues and clean water issues. I'll continue to do so, but I don't think that making my confirmation a political statement is the right thing to do. I would work very hard, and I know, like I did, I gave you my commitment that if I was elected that I would resign from the position. You know, I've worked very hard being at the meetings that I've attended so far and gained a great deal of information. And I'm committed to the process, so I just appreciate any consideration on that. Thank you.
Chairman, I'd move to lay the nomination on the table.
Sorry about that. the motion is not debatable. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Division's been called. All those in favor of the motion to table, raise your hand.
I'm sorry, for clarity, what was the...
To table the
motion is to
not
table the nomination. All those... I'm sorry. If you're in favor of the motion, raise your hand.
Mr. Chair.
What's the motion?
I know it's not debatable, but may I ask a question?
A point of information is certainly in order.
What I don't understand is whether this motion is required to pass or not to pass in order for the mayor to continue to serve on the council. What would be the impact of this vote?
The impact of this vote would be that we would not consider the nomination today. If we do not consider the nomination within the required number of days within the rules of the Senate, and I have to tell you when that is, the nomination then goes to the full Senate for consideration.
Mr. Chair, if we table it...
If this committee, under the rules of the Senate, if the committee does not act on a nomination within a certain number of days, then it is before the entire Senate, and then the majority leader can then choose to take up the confirmations calendar with this nomination on it. It can also be re-referred to the Committee on Rules, and we referred back to this committee. Those are the options. So the effect of passing this motion would be that this committee does nothing, and then the Senate at some point would then have to act on it in some way.
Information. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Chaudhry.
Point of information, Senator Sharon.
You could, as the chair, take it from the table again in this committee within a certain time frame.
Senator Sharon, I would not be able to take it from the table within the allotted amount of time this committee could vote to take it from the table.
And do you know what that time frame is and whether or not we'll be having a meeting in order to make that happen?
How many days do we have left on this particular? We're not sure how many days we have left.
Where's the date?
We can certainly find that out.
Yeah.
We would have to calculate when this nomination was referred to this committee by the President of the Senate, and then calculate that out. We have not done that yet. Senator Ingebrigtsen, point of information?
Point of information, please. So if this were to be voted into the affirmative, then who would have the authority to bring it back to the table? Somebody who votes in the affirmative, is that correct?
Anybody.
Mr. Chairman, it would be anybody on the committee without a roll call. You vote on the prevailing side, and if it prevails, the table. But since you're doing a voice vote, you wouldn't really have a record of who voted on the prevailing side. So it would really be any of the members that could do that.
So somebody could make a motion to take the nomination from the table if the allotted number of days under the rules of the Senate have not expired. So then we're back to the division on the motion to lay the nomination on the table. Those in favor of it, raise your hand.
Is this laying it on the table? Yes.
And those opposed? On a vote of 7-6, the motion prevails. So then there's no more business before the committee. Committee is adjourned.